In 1971, Baptist pastor Gary Chapman joins the staff of Calvary Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He serves as an associate pastor in charge of family ministries, where it's his job to pastor and to provide programming and teaching for all the families that come into Calvary Baptist Church. 2 decades and 1 year later, Chapman publishes a book that has exploded worldwide. It's called The 5 Love Languages. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that many of you have read this book. Yes, have you? Some have. Others might be familiar with the work itself through the internet or through little inventories that are now around helping people discern their love language. Chapman describes 5 love languages as words of affirmation, acts of service, physical touch, quality time, and receiving gifts. That these are 5 ways that humanity is wired to receive love in the world. He, of course, is almost immediately panned by social scientists, saying that there is no data behind the treatise that he writes. However, there is 21 years of data in the practice of Gary Chapman sitting the desk at Calvary Baptist Church. And today, folks still use the 5 love languages to understand how they might practically, logistically, authentically connect with their partners, friends, and other trusted people in relationship one to another. It's a beautiful model, and Chapman is on to something. If I were to direct you right now, if you were to reach into the pew and grab the red book with the big cross on the front of it, the Episcopal Book of Common Prayer, and you were to turn to page 425, 426, something like that. I'm not sure which one it is. Somewhere in between 424 and 428. You're going to come across a section of the marriage liturgy that says the Declaration of Consent. And in the Declaration of Consent, you're going to find the Episcopal marriage liturgy consistent with the ideas and the energy behind Chapman's thought. You see, there is a marked difference between what Episcopalians say in our marriage liturgy and what maybe Hollywood says or the Teton County Courthouse would say if you were to engage in the practice of marriage. When we listen to movies in Hollywood and there's a wedding up on the screen, the bride and the groom say one to another, "I do," right? And that's what we would say in the Teton County Courthouse as well. "I do." The idea would be like you enter single and you depart married. And yet our liturgy, our take on marriage is somewhat different. The marriage itself is described as the celebration and blessing of a marriage. It is not a marriage liturgy where you go in single and you come out married. It is the celebration of 2 people who have picked up a practice, one with another, sometime in the past. And on that day that we push pause and we stop and we celebrate and we bless that marriage, the bride and the groom and all who are gathered together to witness this event respond in a particular way. We Episcopalians say, "I will." it's not something that I am. It's not a condition. It's not that, like, I am married to Cindy and I never have to do anything else to affirm that reality, right? It is that I will continue to marry Cindy until the day that one of us dies or something else goes horribly wrong, right? It is a practice that I engage and that she engages. And then the church itself also says it is a practice that is supported by the loved ones. There is a triptych, an I will, and a we will. Love is meant to be embodied. And Chapman, in his practice as being the associate at Calvary Baptist Church, has seen that romantic couples are struggling to embody love and are relying on the idea that marriage itself is a condition, that it just is. I'm a husband, you're a wife. It just is. But those of us who have been married for more than, say, 72 hours know that, in fact, there is the utmost importance that our loving relationships are embodied. I love it, Feather. Keep singing, babe. We're getting to that. Chapman speaks of this. Chapman's arguments are a subset of this problem that we have with the faith, especially with the faith in the West. There's this idea of, like, well, I'm a Christian. Well, I'm a believer. This idea that the faith itself that Jesus talks about, teaches, and embodies is somehow conceptual and something that we make a decision about in our minds rather than something we live day in and day out. We who sit the pews in the church in these days know that there's something missing if we just believe. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that you are not beloved. I'm not saying that you are not smothered in the grace of God. I am talking about our human responsiveness to that grace. What do we do when we begin to acknowledge and bring that grace into our lives? Well, we don't just sit there and think about it. We want to live it. We want to live that kind of love in the world amongst people we know and love and amongst strangers we don't yet know. There's something beautiful that happens there. Well, Jesus, in the gospel that we have for this morning, directs us to embody the faith in a very particular way. We have this parable of the mustard seed. It's probably, honestly, like the most popular children's Sunday school lesson of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The earnest Sunday school volunteer goes to the grocery store on Saturday at noon and scours the spice aisle for that mustard seed, opens it up, and to his or her surprise, it is a tiny seed. That tiny seed in the dry, high desert climate of the Holy Land doesn't become a tree, as the story says, but does become this exceedingly robust bush. A bush where animals, particularly birds, can find their way in between the branches, create nests, and be secure from the wandering eyes of predators. It is a wonderful analogy of something very, very small becoming something big. He uses another example of yeast, a nearly imperceptible ingredient to bread, which gives bread its rise and its heft and its flavor. It brings to bread a personality that bread would not have if it were just flat and chewy. And yet, the addition of the yeast is nearly imperceptible. Jesus is telling us, is teaching us, that it is the little things, it is the little things that lead to the embodiment of love which embodies the faith. One of my most cherished childhood memories happened almost every spring from the time I was maybe 5 years old until about 12 years old when, you know, things kind of turn off. Childhood things turn off and adolescent things turn on. Every spring we would go with some very dear family friends and a few other families as well to a piece of property along the Brazos River in the coastal plains of Texas. Somewhere outside suburban Houston, we would wander the banks of the Brazos River hunting dewberries. Now, let me be clear. The Brazos River is not the Snake River. The Brazos River might be very snaky, but it is not the Snake River. It is a brown stream that flows through coastal Texas and dumps somewhere into the brown Gulf of Mexico. But along the banks of the Brazos River, on this particular piece of property, every spring grew a bountiful crop of dewberries. Dewberries, if you don't know, are very much like blackberries, kind of a mix between a blackberry and a raspberry. And each of us would be armed with a bucket and a broomstick. That broomstick you used to rattle the bush before you stuck your hand in it, in case there was a water moccasin, a copperhead, or a rattlesnake. Welcome to Texas. If there is a venomous snake in North America, it happens to live in Texas. At the end of the day, almost every year, our buckets and coolers and other things would be filled with dewberries. This is not why I'm telling you this story. The Bartz family would then return to our house where the dewberries in their bucket or whatever container would be turned over to a woman named Verley Mae Smith. Verley was our housekeeper and a child care giver ever since I can remember. Verley was an exceedingly important person in my life, and all the structures of systemic racism that were there in the 1970s surrounded the relationship that I and my brother had with our African-American caregiver, Verley. I don't deny that. But what I can tell you is this woman, Verlie Mae Smith, loved my brother and me so profoundly and so beautifully and so tenderly that in my mind, she is the mother figure that I always craved from my single parent mom, who was more the strong taskmaster and disciplinarian. Verlie loved Reed Bartz and Jimmy Bartz in such a profound and beautiful way, and talking about her today makes me miss her, her embrace and her care. The Dewberries would be turned over to Verlie, and she would make a Dewberry cobbler. Out of that cobbler, which I absolutely loved, on top of that cobbler was a lattice crust. And for some reason, I don't even know why, but for some reason as a kid, that lattice crust symbolized nurture and love and care for me in such a profound way that I can get right back there with my feelings as I tell you this story. Now, flash forward 35 years. Some of you know, and maybe I've said in a sermon before, I work with an executive coach twice a month. I have for 12 years. Her name is Whitney Birdwell, and Whitney helps keep me on track. She helps me write goals and executes on those goals. She helps me think through challenges in the workplace or challenges in my personal life. She's a great coach. And maybe a year or so ago, Whitney was running me through a little exercise. And that exercise was, what was I going to do in retirement? And she's like, have you ever given that any thought, what you're going to do in retirement? I was like, yeah, I know. Like, I know exactly what I'm going to do in retirement. I'm going to do three things. And she's like, great, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to catch trout. I'm going to take pictures of beautiful animals. And I am going to make pies with lattice crusts for people I know and love, or people I want to get to know and love. For some reason, the lattice crust is such a powerful symbol for me in my life as an act of service, a loving, caring act of service. And so yesterday, I made you a lattice crust. You, this church. I got up in the morning before my family was awake, and I began to make this pie. And as I made this pie, I prayed for Rob, who's in the hospital. Prayed for Ed and Judith, who are kind of trapped at home, recovering from surgery. I prayed for Lily and her knee's recovery. I prayed for Ed wearing his clamshell and hoping that his back would get better. I prayed for my daughter Jade and all of her classmates that are suffering from moderate to severe senioritis right now. I prayed for the flourishing of this congregation, St. John's Episcopal Church. I prayed for the community of Jackson Hole. I prayed for our country that is so divided right now that we might find our way back one to another. Jesus asks of his disciples in the 13th chapter of the Gospel of John, how will the world know that you are my disciples? And then he answers the question for them. He says, by the way that you love one another. We know from this analogy of the mustard seed that the way that we love one another is in the small things. It's in a text. It's in a ride. It's in a visit. It's in a note. It's in a smile. It's in a song sung for someone who needs to be sung back to themselves. It's in a poem. It's in a pie. Church, how will they know? How will they know that we, St. John's, are devoted to the faith, which is grounded in a God who we know to be love? They will know by the small things, the small loving things that we do for one another, those we know and love, and that we do for strangers, those we don't yet know and love. It's in the small things. Amen.